Then a gray floor obscured my vision, slipping below my feet like an iris closing. The next thing I knew, I was sitting in a messy, round room. My impression is that at this point, I was actually being cradled by these people, as if they were aware of what was about to transpire. Movement to this totally unfamiliar environment. So suddenly, and under these extremely unusual conditions, stripped away whatever reserves of collectedness I still possessed, while I had up to that point been able to retain a degree of control of my attention, this now left me and I became extremely given over to extreme dread. The fear was so powerful that it seemed to make my personality completely evaporate. This was not a theoretical or even a mental experience, but something profoundly physical. Whitley, that's me, ceased to exist. What was left was a body in a state of raw fear, so great that it swept about me like a thick, suffocating curtain, turning paralysis into a condition that seemed close to death. I do not think that my ordinary humanity survived the transition to this little room. I died and a wild animal appeared in my place. Not everything was gone, though. What remained, although small, nevertheless was occupied with an essential task of verification. I was looking around as best I could, recording what I saw. The small circular chamber had a domed, grayish tan ceiling with ribs appearing at intervals of about a foot. I had an impression that it was a messy living space. Across the room to my right, some clothing was thrown on the floor. As a matter of fact, the thought even crossed my mind that the place was actually dirty. It was close and confining for me. The whole scale of it was small, tight, and enclosed. I seem to remember that the room was stuffy and the air quite dry, so it could be that the numbness of panic was wearing off. Tiny people were now moving around me at great speed. Their quickness was disturbing and, in a curious way, ugly. I had the thought that I was being taken away and remembered my family. An acute, gnawing feeling of being in a trap overcame me. It was a truly awful sensation, accompanied as it was by the sense that I was absolutely helpless in the hands of these strange creatures. Despite my extreme terror, I was aware of my surroundings. I know that I was seated on a bench, leaning against a wall. The predominant colors were tan and gray. The bench was the same color as the walls and was rimmed by a lip of dark brown. From the clarity of my memory of these rather muted colors, I surmised that the room was lit, although I did not see the source of the light. There was something quite beautiful, I think, having to do with a lens in the ceiling. But I can remember little about it. Perhaps there was a lens at the point of the ceiling, through which some colorful scene could be observed. There is no way to be certain of how long I remained in this room. It seemed to be a stay of no more than a few minutes or even seconds. It may have been longer, though, because I had time to look around me and note numerous details. While I had before been totally paralyzed, I was now able to move at least my eyes and possibly my head. I was so scared that my memories are indistinct and covered by amnesia. Even as I write this, I am aware that a great deal more happened. I just can't get to it. This might be terror, amnesia, or drugs, or hypnosis, or even doses of all three. There is one drug, tetrodotoxin, which could approximate such a state. In small doses, it causes external anesthesia. Larger doses bring about the out-of-the-body sensation occasionally reported to victims of visitor abduction. Greater quantities can cause the appearance of death. Even the brain ceases detectable function. This rare drug is the core of the zombie poison of Haiti, and little is known about why it works as it does. It is also the notorious Fugu poison of Japan, found in the tissues of a blowfish, which is an esteemed, if deadly, aphrodisiac. My surroundings were so unfamiliar in every detail, and my surprise was so great that I simply faded away, in the sense that my ability to direct myself was lost, mentally as well as physically. Not only was I physically anesthetized, although no longer so much paralyzed as totally limp, I was in a mental state that separated me from myself so completely that I had no way to filter my emotions or most immediate reactions, nor could my personality initiate anything. I was reduced to raw biological response. It was as if my forebrain had been separated from the rest of my system, and all that remained was a primitive creature I was, however, in my forebrain, locked away from the rest of myself. My mind had become a prison, one being on my right, another was on my left. Within my field of vision, a great deal of rushing about commenced again. The next thing I knew, I was being shown a tiny gray box with a sliding lid. There was a curved lip at one end of this box to make it easy to push it open. It was being held by a thin, graceful person whose appearance was not distinct. Was this the female again? I'm not sure. It almost seems as I remember that something had been done to my eyes to affect my ability to concentrate my vision. Glances around the room were quite detailed in recollection, but any attempts to steady my vision and view a particular being resulted in blurring. It would be interesting to know if this was an induced effect or something caused by my own fear of what I was seeing. My memory of the one that came before me next is of a tiny, squat person crouching as if huddled over something. He had been given the box and now slid it open, revealing an extremely shiny, hair-thin needle mounted on a black surface. This needle glittered when I saw it out of the corner of my eye, but was practically invisible straight on. I became aware, I think I was told, that they proposed to insert this into my brain. If I had been afraid before, I now became quite simply crazed with terror. I argued with them. "This place is filthy," I remember saying. Not a very good argument designed to make friends with your hosts carrying a needle they're going to stick in your brain. "This place is filthy," I remember saying. "Then you'll ruin a beautiful mind." Better than having a dirty mind. Wonder what they'd have done if he'd have said, "This place is beautiful, you'll ruin a dirty mind." His approach didn't work. I can imagine my family awakening in the morning and finding me a vegetable. A great sadness overtook me. I do not recall screaming, but evidently I was doing so because I remember the next exchange quite clearly. One of them, I think it was the one I'd identified earlier as the woman, said, quote, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" I could have answered that. Now, this book and another one, The Intruders, has taken the nation by storm. If you think the UFO phenomenon has died down, these two books will tell you differently. As I was reading it the other night, one caller said they had seen the author on Johnny Carson. Another one had just watched him in Connecticut. Another one said he was going to be on in San Francisco. And to you that have gone to try to buy it, it's probably out of the bookstores. "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" she said. This voice was remarkable. It was definitely oral, that is to say, I heard it rather than sensed it. It had a subtle electronic tone to it, the accents flat and startlingly Midwestern. My reply was unexpected. "Have you put some new lights in here?" "Huh? Talk to me, engineers."
"No.
Why does it seem brighter in here? Somebody coming to get me or something?" My reply was unexpected to her question, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" I heard myself say, "You could let me smell you." I was embarrassed. That is not a normal request, and it bothered me. But it made a great deal of sense, as I've afterward realized. The one to my right replied, okay, I can do that. In a similar voice, speaking very rapidly, and held his hand against my face, cradling my head with his other hand. The odor was distinct and gave me exactly what I needed, an anchor in reality. It remained the most convincing aspect of the whole memory because that odor was completely indistinguishable from a real one. It did not seem in any way a dream experience or a hallucination. I remembered it as an actual smell. There was a slight scent of cardboard to it, as if the sleeve of the coverall that was partly pressed against my face were made of some substance like paper. The hand itself had a faint but distinctly organic sourness in its odor. It was not a human smell, but it was unmistakably the smell of something alive. There was a subtle overtone that seemed a little like cinnamon. The next thing I knew, shall I or shall I not? You want me to continue with this?
Yes, sir.
Now, many of those who listen to me have already read this book. Scared the hell out of some of them. Now, the interpretation I'll give you, should you be interested enough for me to finish, may be a little different than other explanations. And it'll lead us back to some other things I didn't finish teaching in the distant past. Shall I continue?
Yes, sir.
The next thing I knew, there was a bang and a flash. And I realized that they had performed the proposed operation on my head. I felt like weeping, and I recall sinking down into a cradle of tiny arms. At this point, I had some feeling, and enough muscle tone had returned to enable me to slide my feet along the floor in an effort to avoid falling all the way. Then I was lifted up and seemed suddenly to be in another room. Or perhaps I simply saw my present surroundings differently. It appeared to be a small operating theater. I was in the center of it on a table, and three tiers of benches were populated with a few huddled figures, some with round as opposed to slanted eyes. I was aware that I had seen four different types of figures. The first was the small, robo-like being that had led the way into my bedroom. He was followed by a large group of short, stocky ones in the dark blue coveralls. These had wide faces, appearing either dark gray or dark blue in that light, with glittering, deep-set eyes, pug noses, and broad, somewhat human mouths. Inside the room, I encountered two types of creatures that didn't look at all human. Two types of creatures that didn't look at all human. One looked like a TV evangelist. The most provocative of these was about 5 feet tall, very slender, I added that, very slender and delicate, with extremely prominent and mesmerizing black slanted eyes. This being had an almost vestigial mouth and nose. The huddled figures in the theater were somewhat smaller, with similarly shaped heads but round black eyes like large buttons. Throughout the whole experience, the stocky ones were always present. They were apparently responsible for moving and controlling me, and I had the distinct expression that they were a sort of good army. Why good, I do not know. I do not remember what, if anything, happened in the operating theater. My memories of movement from place to place are the hardest to recall because it was then that I felt the most helpless. My fear would rise when they touched me. Their hands were soft, even soothing, but there were so many of them that it felt a little as if I were being passed along by rows of insects. It was very distressing. Soon, I was in more intimate surroundings once again. There were clothes thrown about, and two of the stocky ones drew my legs apart. The next thing I knew, I was being shown an enormous and extremely ugly object, gray and scaly with a sort of network of wires on the end. It was at least a foot long, narrow, and triangular in structure. It's going to get pretty gross. They inserted this thing into my rectum. It seemed to swarm into me as if it had a life of its own. Apparently, its purpose was to take samples. Possibly a fecal matter, but at the time I had the impression that I was being raped, and for the first time I felt anger. Only when the thing was withdrawn did I see that it was a mechanical device. The individual holding it pointed to the wire cage on the tip and seemed to warn me about something, but what, I never found out. Events once again started moving very quickly. One of them took my right hand and made an incision in my forefinger. There was no pain at all. Abruptly, my memory's end. There isn't even blackness, just morning. I had no further recollection of the incident. I awoke the morning of the 27th very much as usual, but grappling with a distinct sense of unease and a very improbable but intense memory of seeing a barn owl staring at me through the window sometime during the night. I remember how I felt in the gathering evening of the 27th, when I looked out onto the roof and saw that there were no owl tracks in the snow. I knew I'd not seen an owl. I shuddered, suddenly cold, and drew back from the window, withdrawing from the night that was falling so swiftly in the woods beyond. But I wanted desperately to believe in that owl. I told my wife about it. She was polite, but commented about the absence of tracks. I really very much wanted to convince her of it, though. Even more, I wanted to convince myself. So intent was I on this that I telephoned a friend in California for the specific, yet unlikely, purpose of telling her about the barn owl at the window. Later, I discovered that memories of animals in strange places are a common block to this experience. One young woman arrived back at a picnic in the woods in France with a story of seeing a beautiful deer. But she had blood on her blouse and a strange, straight scar that could not be explained. 10 years passed before she remembered anything of the truth of her experience in those woods, and she would have died with that memory had not her memory of another encounter with the visitors caused her to question its real significance. Another man I interviewed came away from his experience thinking only that he had seen a bunch of rabbits hopping around outside his car. Like my barn owl. These stories must have seemed no more than whimsies, but they hid real experiences that were so impossible to accept. Just keeping them hidden took a large toll, as it has with others, as it might be doing with anybody. From that first day, my wife noticed a dramatic personality change in me, which she thought was similar to a change that had taken place the previous October. We had gone through personal hell then because of my demands and accusatory behavior, and she did not want that pattern to repeat itself. But I was in decline again. And this time, the symptoms were not all mental. That first evening, I underwent the initial physical symptom of my ordeal. This is what takes it beyond just a bad dream. That first evening, I underwent the initial physical symptom of my ordeal. We had come in from an afternoon of light cross-country skiing, not at all strenuous. I was dead tired. Normally, I'm full of energy. Even a hard afternoon on the ski trails leaves me feeling pleasantly relaxed. I got chills and went to bed. I lay huddled between the sheets and the quilt with evening coming down, feeling just awful. I thought I must have had a high fever. I was exhausted. The sounds of my wife and son downstairs filled me with a sense of foreboding. Strange recollections of people running, of being pulled and shoved, swirled through my head. Then our nearest neighbors suddenly arrived. They appeared without warning. Now, we tend to be very private in our sparse community, and this was only their second spontaneous visit in the 2 years we had been neighbors. Feeling somewhat better, I went downstairs to see them. No sooner had we started talking than I found myself complaining that I thought I'd seen the light of a snowmobile in the woods between our houses at about 3 a.m. I was horrified at myself. What was I saying? I couldn't remember any such thing, and I knew it even as I spoke. Our neighbors offered the thought that the woods were too thick for snowmobiles to maneuver in, which is true. Then I said that it must have been the lights on his house. He has two floodlights that shine out over his backyard. He explained that these lights had been off, but promised to redirect them so they couldn't be seen from our house. I knew even then that his lights hadn't been bothering me so late at night. My memory of the snowmobile was as hollow as my memory of the owl. After some small talk, our neighbors went home. I was not pleased with my own behavior and found it hard to understand because it seemed so non-volitional, almost as if I had been talking against my will. My wife reports that my personality deteriorated dramatically over the following weeks. I became hypersensitive, easily confused, and worst of all, short with my son. We've always been a happy family, and there was no change in our life condition or relationship to account for this personality shift. The realization that the owl memory was not true created troubling problems for me. I was aware that something had somehow gone wrong with me. The trouble was I couldn't understand what it was. There simply wasn't anything in my life to explain it. I started to worry about toxins in our food or water, but as nobody else in the family was affected and we hadn't tried any food that might cause some bizarre allergy, that seemed unlikely. I did not know that the owl and the light were screen memories that concealed a traumatic experience. As described by Freud, the screen memory is a method that the mind uses to shield itself from things too upsetting to recall. It gets worse. I had a feeling of being separated from myself, as if either I was unreal or the world around me was unreal. By December 28th, I was so depressed and in such a state of inner conflict that I sat down and wrote a short story in an effort to explore my emotions. It reflected not only my emotional state, but probably also some of the realities hidden behind it. I called it pain. It was to be the last sustained writing I'd do for 7 weeks and is the last thing I wrote before these enormous hidden truths begin emerging from my unconscious. In the ensuing days, I experienced more bouts of fatigue. I would be working, and suddenly I'd get cold and start to shake. Then I'd feel so exhausted I couldn't go on, crawl into bed quivering and miserable, sure I was coming down with the flu. Nights I would sleep, but wake up in the morning feeling as if I'd been tossing and turning the whole time. I ceased to dream, sometimes had difficulty closing my eyes. I felt watched and kept hearing noises in the night. On the afternoon of January 3rd, we were skiing when I got a pain behind my right ear. It was a sensation similar to what happens to one's jaw when Novocaine wears off after a session in the dentist chair. My skull ached. The skin was sensitive. In the middle of this sensitive area, my wife could see a tiny pinpoint of a scab. My finger became infected. Rectal pain began to accompany the other symptoms. And I believe that the combination of the infected finger, the rectal pain, and the aching head were what finally brought my memories into focus. The confused swirl resolved into a specific series of recollections. And when I saw what they were, I just about exploded with terror and utter disbelief. One of the memories would come into my head, linger there a moment, then leave me with my heart pounding, gasping, sweat pouring down my face, until I thought I'd lost my mind. I thought quietly and calmly, you may be going mad, or you may have a brain tumor. You got to find out what it is and take whatever steps are necessary. Sitting in my office, I rested my head on the desk and quite frankly cried. For a couple of days, I lived with it. Maybe the symptoms would subside. Then quite suddenly, one afternoon, then, quite suddenly, one afternoon,